Have you ever heard the phrase, put up or shut up? I know it sounds a little crude, but how many have actually heard that phrase? How many have actually had that phrase said to them? Okay, a few. Usually that happens on a basketball court, a sports venue, where somebody is a little too big for their britches. And they're bragging about themselves and their own attitude or their own ability to score, whatever it might be. And somebody else says to them, put up or shut up. Now, there may be other venues in which that is stated. But I'll tell you what, it's not a bad saying when it comes to Christianity. Today we're going to talk about put out, put in, and put on. Turn with me to Leviticus chapter 23. We've divided this sermon into three sections, put out, put in, and put on. Section number one is put out. Now, we're not talking about output. That's a different story. Output, obviously, is what you're producing in regard to your work. Leviticus 23 reminds us that we've got some things to put out. Leviticus 23 and verse 4. Now we often turn, of course, on a holy day, as we should, to Leviticus chapter 23, because each of the holy days is listed in order. It's a convenient place to do it. It's not the only place we could obviously turn, but it is a convenient one. We'll read in verse 4, these are the feasts of the eternal. So if you want to keep the feasts that are God's, these are the ones you are to keep, not the ones that the world, for example, will keep tomorrow. That's not one of God's feasts. These are the feasts of the eternal. Holy convocations. So Christians are here convoking today, not tomorrow on the world's Easter Sunday. These are the holy convocations which you shall proclaim at their appointed times. We either do what God says or we do not. Verse 15 or verse 5. On the 14th day of the first month at twilight is the Lord's Passover. We all kept that just a few nights ago. Then in verse 6, on the 15th day, which began last night at sundown, on the 15th day of the same month is the feast of unleavened bread to the eternal. 7 days you must eat unleavened bread. So what did we put out? So you see, the putting out process should have been something that's been now accomplished as far as putting out the leaven, verse 7. On the first day, you shall have a holy convocation. That's why we're meeting together today. It is a holy or a sacred convention or convocation or assembly. You shall do no customary work on it. So we're all resting today, verse 8. But you shall offer an offering made by fire to the eternal for 7 days. So, as you know, we don't offer offerings made by fire because Christ's sacrifice fulfilled each of those sacrifices that no longer are given. The 7th day shall be a holy convocation. You shall do no customary work on it. So we have a responsibility to appear before God today and put out the leaven. These are days of unleavened bread. Turn back a few chapters to Exodus chapter 12. Exodus chapter 12. I'd like to read with you verse 14. The reason we'll go back to read this one more time is simply because many in the world who comment about the days of unleavened bread say that Israel kept unleavened bread simply because they didn't have enough time to make leavened bread. Now, in that day and age, leavened bread took a little bit longer than it might today. They didn't have those nice little silver foil packets full of billions of yeast spores to be able to pour into their dough. They had to leave it out and let it, oh, they may have a starter from another thing. How many of you done Amish bread starters here? Okay, most everybody. How long does it take? How long do you keep it before you actually bake it? Is it about a week? Okay, it gives you an idea, right? So they'll say that they just didn't have time to leaven their bread. But remember, God gave this instruction before they ever packed up and left, so they were prepared when the time came. So here in Exodus 12, verse 14, this is before Mount Sinai. This is before the official codification of the Ten Commandments. In effect, it's before the institution of the Old Covenant. So, verse 14, "So this day shall be to you a memorial. You shall keep it as a feast to the Eternal throughout your generations. You shall keep it as a feast by an everlasting ordinance." An eternal ordinance, we might say. Everlasting. As long as there's people, there'll be the days of unleavened bread. Verse 15. 7 days you shall eat unleavened bread. On the first day, you shall remove leaven from your houses. Now pause for a second there. The Hebrew is clear in the sense that it indicates on the first day you shall have removed. It's past tense. And of course, that makes sense. That's the way it ought to be translated, because God goes on to say this is a rest day. So you don't clean your house on the rest day. You shall have put leaven out. So when we say today, put out, what we're talking about is we had the responsibility prior to sunset last night to put out anything that had leaven. Any of our edible products that would have leaven in them, we got them out. On the first day you shall have removed leaven from your homes, middle of verse 15. For whoever eats leavened bread from the first day until the seventh day, that person shall be cut off from Israel. So physically, an Israelite who rebelled and just decided, I'm going to eat leavened bread anyway, would be cast out of the community, would be put out. Symbolic, of course, that those who rebel against God's command today would be put out of spiritual Israel, the new Israel of God, according to the New Testament. So, verse 16, on the first day there shall be a holy convocation. Again, a commanded, sacred assembly of God's people. And on the seventh day there shall be a holy convocation for you. No manner of work may be done in them, but that which everyone must eat, that only may be prepared by you. So verse 17, so you shall observe the feast of unleavened bread. For on this same day I will have brought your armies out of the land of Egypt. So for Israel, they kept the days of unleavened bread to remember the fact that God brought them out of slavery, out of bondage. Spiritually speaking, we keep the days of unleavened bread to remind us that God has removed us from the slavery of sin into a whole new way of life. Rest of verse 17. Therefore, you shall observe this day throughout your generations as an everlasting ordinance. So throughout your generations, we still keep this ordinance today. Verse 18, again a reminder. How many times does God say? In the first month, 14th day of the month at even, you shall eat unleavened bread until the 21st day of the month at even. For 7 days no leaven shall be found in your houses, since whoever eats what is leavened, that same person shall be cut off from the congregation of Israel, whether he's a stranger or a native of the land. You shall eat nothing leavened. In all your dwellings you shall eat unleavened bread. So Christians become label readers and flatbread eaters. They study labels of things that they would consume to be sure there's no leavening in them, and that is put out. Now again, we clearly understand that leaven is to be a representation of sin. And we, as Christians, are asked to put out sin, to change the way that we live. Notice down a few verses in verse 41. Exodus 12, verse 41. And it came to pass at the end of 430 years on that very same day, that it came to pass that all the armies or the hosts of the Eternal went out from the land of Egypt. They were sprung by the great miracles that God had performed. Verse 42 is what we did last night. It is a night of solemn observance to the Eternal, for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. So I hope either before or after your meal, and your time of fellowshipping together with the brethren, that you did have some time of solemnness before God to appreciate the amazing thing that He's done in giving us this tremendous understanding, this advanced knowledge. It's a night of solemn observance in that regard. So we put out sin. We put out leaven. Whatever the kinds of leaven that it might be, we get rid of it. Whether it's a granola bar that looks pretty flat, if it has leavening in it, we get rid of it. Turn over a page to Exodus chapter 13. Again, God is a reminding God. Sometimes we've heard the phrase that repetition is what? The best form of emphasis. Well, if that's the case, God must have known that because He repeats it again in chapter 13. In verse 3, Moses said to the people, "Remember this day in which you went out of Egypt, out of the house of bondage." So I hope that at some point in the course of the events of yesterday, you thought about your baptism. You thought about what you were thinking at that time, the commitment that you were making to God when you were put under the water. And the new man came out and the old man stayed behind. Hope you thought about that. If you haven't, maybe some time today would be some time to do that, to remember that God rescued us from a completely futile way of life. The rest of the verse says in verse 3, "For by strength of hand the Eternal brought you out of this place. No leavened bread shall be eaten." So I suppose we could say that we avoid leaven during these days in one sense as an appreciation for what God has done for us. As an appreciation. Now, again, we've gotten very sophisticated in our unleavened bread making. In that, if you take any amount of flour and put enough butter in it, it's awesome. You can put cottage cheese in it. We had these wonderful cottage cheese blintzes this morning, and these are awesome. So sometimes it's a difficult thing to say, well, this is a sacrifice to eat unleavened bread. Our daughter can't wait for my wife to make cottage cheese rolls that are only made during the days of unleavened bread. Now, she's not keeping the days of unleavened bread right now, but she loves those cottage cheese rolls because they're just dripping with butter. I mean, it's like eating a stick of butter. No, it's not that bad. It's wonderful. But it's a thankfulness to God when we eat unleavened bread. It's a reminder that He has granted us unbelievable understanding. Verse 4, "On this day you are going out in the month Abib. And it shall be when the Eternal brings you in the land of the Canaanites and the Hittites, the Amorites, the Hivites, the Jebusites, which He swore to your fathers to give you, a land flowing with milk and honey." And of course, milk makes butter, so I'm sure that was part of it. "That you shall keep this service in this month." So we don't have the option of deciding that we should come up with new days to try to honor God. God says, you keep this service when I command you to. That's what shows honor to God. "You keep this service in this month." Verse 6, "7 days you shall eat unleavened bread." So the leaven had to be put out. "On the 7th day there shall be a feast to the Eternal. Unleavened bread shall be eaten," guess, 7 days. "No leavened bread shall be seen among you, nor shall leaven be seen among you in all your quarters," or your boundaries. So we rid our property of leaven. Again, it's a symbolic gesture that we're striving to thoroughly rid ourselves of sin. Verse 8, "And you shall tell your son in that day, saying, this is done because of what the Eternal did for me when I came up from Egypt. Shall be a sign to you on your hand and as a memorial between your eyes." We have a responsibility to teach our children these things. And again, the church has provided some outstanding materials for us to be able to do that, to help in that process. "Shall be a sign to you on your hand as a memorial between your eyes." In other words, everything we do, everything we think is affected by this, "that the Eternal's law may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand the Eternal has brought you out of Egypt. You shall therefore keep this ordinance in its season from year to year." It's interesting this morning as I was praying, I see a jet airliner. You know how they start climbing and they hit that area where the contrail starts to form and they continue on, and thinking, you know, there's a couple hundred people in that little silver canister flying in the air. It just caused me to reflect, they have no concept at all about what God expects of them and how unique the knowledge is that God has given to you and to me of what He is doing on the earth, the plan that He is working out. It's an awesome opportunity. Turn now to Colossians chapter 3. We've said, and you know, you've heard it before, put out the leaven. So when we say put out, and we say put out the leaven, what are we talking about? Well, we know, physically speaking, we've had to get rid of the breads. Maybe those stone-ground wheat bread, or whatever you might have, the Ezekiel breads, or whatever it is that you particularly like, the English muffins with all those little crevices that the butter and honey just collect in. Whatever it might be, you've gotten rid of that. But what's the point? The point is to get rid of sin. So let's get a little more specific. What are some of the things that God expects you and me to put out? You probably thought about those things. Hope your Passover examination was not just a list of sins, but also a list of projects, of goals, of things that need to be done, not just what needs to be avoided. Colossians 3, in verse 5, leads us through a list of a few things that God would expect us to be working on, to be putting out. Beginning in verse 5, Paul writes to the Colossian church, therefore, he summarizes what he's covered in the first several verses. In other words, if we're converted, if we have God's Spirit, if we have accepted the sacrifice of Christ, then he comes to verse 5, therefore, put to death your members which are on the earth. Members are literally limbs. He's saying, cut these things off, put these things to death that cause these kinds of sins and problems. So he begins the list with fornication. Now, fornication is an embarrassing thing to talk about because it has to do with sex. And sex is an embarrassing and uncomfortable thing to talk about. But the Bible talks about it often. So should we. Literally, the word is porneia and refers to sexual immorality. Is that something that we need to talk about? And the answer is absolutely. In a culture that is saturated with sexual immorality and getting more so all the time, it is critically important that Christians understand that that's one thing that has to be put to death, sexual immorality. So if we've struggled with things in regard to sexual immorality, whether it's porneia, from which porneia, pornography is where we get that, that's something that we may need to be working on. It has to be put out. It cannot be tolerated. Any kind of sexual immorality, God says, to flee from. He goes on to say a related word, the second word, uncleanness. Uncleanness has to do with moral and physical impurity. Another word that some translations use, they use sexual immorality followed by perversion. And our culture is filled with perverse things that should not even be discussed, let alone watched or participated in any way. So if we're dealing with that, that's something that needs to go out. And it is so accessible in our culture today. So it's something we need to be very, very careful with. And it may need to be given some attention to work on to make sure it's not causing us a problem. Let's go on to the third word. The third thing, and again, we'll just be very frank. He says it's the word passion. This word is only used three times in the New Testament. It means vile passions or depraved passions. So I wonder if what was going on in the Corinthian, or I should say the Colossian culture, was somewhat similar to what's going on in our culture today, where there are depraved passions. Again, not just in relation to sexuality, although that's perverted more, it seems, than about anything else. He links that together with the next word, evil desire. It is possible if we wash our minds in this sexual immorality, in perversion, in depraved passions, it is possible to develop evil desires. It is possible to develop addictions. So we want to be, again, very careful. We want to ask God to help us to put out the things that our culture revels in, that our culture makes fun of or considers liberated. Our culture today makes fun of you because you think these things are wrong and sinful. Our culture does not know what sin is anymore, if they ever did. They don't consider it. Well, sin, this is just a lifestyle. If they want to do it, it's up to them. And if you think differently, something's wrong with you. Our culture is sick in that regard. The next word he goes on to touch is covetousness. Covetousness. These are all related. In this sense, covetousness simply means a greedy desire to have more. Does that describe our culture? Ever bigger things to have? Ever more modern things to have? When is what we have ever enough in our culture? You ever hear an advertisement to say, you know, if your refrigerator happens to die, please consider buying ours. They tell you that? No. It's, you still got an old fridge, you ain't got water in the door? You don't have ice in the door? What is wrong with you people? You live in the Stone Age? You know, we got stuff that you need. You can go into your fridge, and it's a smart fridge, and you can tell it what to order for you at the grocery store. You don't have one of those? What's wrong with you people? Now, again, I'm being facetious. But does our culture suffer from a greedy desire to have more? Does our nation suffer with a greedy desire to have more? Oh, can't be. How do we explain $1 trillion of debt as a nation if we are not infected with a greedy desire to always have more? When is enough enough? When is, you know, I've got plenty. Let me help somebody else. Now there are some in our culture that see the light, but very few. As a culture, we certainly don't. And he says, covetousness, which is idolatry. Why is covetousness idolatry? Why does it have to go? Because covetousness questions God's goodness toward us. Questions His provision for us. Again, He hasn't given me what I want. Therefore, I want more. It's His fault that I don't have what I want. It's a sad attitude to be involved with. So that needs to be put out. Fornication, uncleanness, passion, evil desire, and covetousness, which is idolatry. Then he goes on. He doesn't stop there. We might be saying, well, I wish he would. Already I've got plenty to work on. It says in verse 6, because of these things, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience. We don't see it yet. In fact, it seems that God still has allowed Israel to have a bit of a hedge. Very few things have actually come to pass that God says He is going to bring. But they will come. The wrath of God is coming. Paul could state that categorically. It is true. When is up to God. Point is, you and I obviously don't want to be in the path of that wrath when it comes. Because it'll hit like a tsunami. And one minute the ground is dry, and the next minute you're in water up to your neck or beyond. So he says in verse 7, because of these things, verse 6, the wrath of God is coming upon the sons of disobedience, in which you yourselves once walked when you lived in them. We've come out of that. They've been put out. Verse 8, but now you yourselves are to put off or put out all of these. And he continues the list. So if we haven't already put together a few things that we need to be working on, he continues the list. He says, first of all, malice. Put off these. Anger is the first. I'm sorry. Anger. And then he follows that with wrath. Anger and wrath. Now, what's the difference between anger and wrath? We tend to use them interchangeably. Anger, in this case, is talking about the underlying attitude, the settled attitude that underlies things. Have you ever known someone who's an angry person? That there's just kind of a brooding anger there. We're to come out of that. The wrath, then, is the uncontrolled outburst of anger, where there's somebody's wrathful, that they just lost control. They fly off the handle. We're to come out of that. And many times, we probably all ask God for forgiveness for outbursts, whether they happen with someone else or by ourselves. Ever been driving by yourself and seen anger turn into wrath? Well, I look in that little rear view mirror, and who's looking back? My wife. No. It's me. I may be all by myself, but the wrath can come. Uncontrolled outburst. God says, come out. Put that off. Put it out. Then he says the third word, malice. Malice. Malice is ill will. It's a desire to injure. One definition says wickedness, depravity. Wickedness that is not ashamed to break laws. Again, this underlying attitude of ill will and a desire to just have it out for other people. You've probably known people like that or seen people like that. You talk to them and you're like, what's wrong with it? What's the chip on this person's shoulder? Why are they so upset? Why is this? You just sense this spirit there that is not God's. The next word he says is blasphemy. Blasphemy. Now, we're all familiar with the blasphemy that is blasphemy toward God. That's an injurious or impious, it's a reproachful speech toward God. But in this case, in the context of dealing with other human beings, blasphemy means slander. It means detraction. It means speech that injures another person's good name. In other words, we might say abusive words toward others are blasphemy toward others. They're made in the image of God. We're asked to honor them. And when we do these things, when we slander them, when we speak abusively toward them, that's a blasphemy toward another person. God says, come out of that. Put that out. Put it off. Then he says, filthy language. Filthy language. That means foul speaking. Low and obscene speech. Gutter talk, we might say in modern terms. Potty mouth might be another term. Shameful speaking is another definition of filthy language. King James says filthy communication. So we ask ourselves, how have we been talking? If our words were to be analyzed, if we had a printout that someone could read back to us, would it be of positive things, of godly things? Or would it be filthy language? Would it be shameful speaking? There are some things that simply should not be spoken of. Paul says that when he talks about some of the behavior that his people were involved with. He said, you're doing things that even the Gentiles are ashamed to speak of. You don't even talk about those things, let alone participate in them. Then he says the word lying. Lying. We're to put off lying. While the word means to lie or speak deliberate falsehoods, in the context of dealing with others as it is here, It means to deceive one by a lie, or to lie to. Tyndale commentary says this, whether it be a deliberate untruth, which is a lie, or the half-truth which conveys a wrong impression, or the exaggeration which distorts facts, all these savor the old, unregenerate nature. So those are to be put off. And when he uses the term put off, it means take it off like soiled clothing. Turn over a few pages to Ephesians chapter 4 in verse 21. The reason I'll turn here is because same thing is mentioned, that we put off the old man, the old way of life. We put it out. We set it out to the curb like we would a cat. Okay, maybe I shouldn't quite say that. Cats sometimes need to be put out just so it can do cat things and then come back. These are things to put out. Tease all my cat lover friends. I'm sorry. Can't help myself. I'm trying to put that off, actually. Ephesians 4, verse 21. If indeed you have heard Him and have been taught by Him, as the truth is in Jesus, that you put off, put out, get rid of, put off concerning your former conduct, the old man which grows corrupt according to the deceitful lusts. He talks about grows corrupt. The Greek literally means to shrivel or wither, to spoil by any process, generally to ruin. Especially figuratively, it means moral influences, to deprave. We get more and more depraved if we don't put off the old man, the former conduct. So it's translated to corrupt oneself, to defile or to destroy. So the old man will rot us from the inside out. So we have a job to do, to put it off like soiled clothing. Remember a few years back, my son and I had a project. We're getting a driveway poured. We had to put in a drain. So we had to dig through the base, the bottom, the base layer of what was in the garage and out into the driveway. And it had been gravel for 40 years, maybe, prior to that. That had been driven over how many thousands of times. So to dig out that trench so a drain could be put in when the concrete was poured was absolute misery. Digging with a shovel is challenging sometimes, but digging through gravel is just misery. So you got your pick, you've got your shovel, you're trying to get this stuff out, and just sweating. Of course, we chose these 90-degree days to do this because that's what you had to do it. Those guys who work in concrete understand the deal. So you got to dig this out, and I mean, within moments, we're just soaked. And then there's the dirt, and maybe if we water this a little bit, it'll loosen it up. Bad idea. Now you're in muck and slime. It's all over. You couldn't wait. After hours and hours of carrying this out to finally get a shower, take off those soiled clothing. And talk about filthy clothes. So when Christ talks about putting off the old man, these things that we've discussed, and there are other sin lists in the Bible that we could turn to and use as self-correction as we go through them, but these give us an idea of the soiled clothing that has to be put off. But we don't want to stop there. We said we're going to talk about three things. Put off, put in, and then put on. So let's talk about putting in. These are not the days of don't eat leaven. Right? These are the days of unleavened bread. So once we've been through the search process of what needs to be put out, we're now in the 7 days of putting in. So we're not worrying, we're not fretting over sin for the next 7 days. We're working on what needs to be put in. So we could go again to a number of lists. I'd like you to turn to Luke chapter 21. We could go through a number of lists in the Scripture of righteous behaviors. But what I chose to do instead was just highlight three very simple things to consider putting in. And you'll find that they're related to many other things as well. But it might give you some ideas as to, okay, if I'm focused completely on sin, here's some things that I could be doing. Putting in. We're to put in unleavened bread. Unleavened bread is to picture actions of righteousness, righteous attitudes. So Luke 21 displays one simple righteous attitude. He, verse 1, looked up, meaning Christ. He looks up, sitting down apparently across from where the treasury was, and he looks up and he sees the people parading through and some pouring in great amounts into the treasury. The treasury was simply a box there, a metal box, into which offerings for the temple were given. He looked up and he saw the rich putting their gifts into the treasury. And he saw also a certain poor widow put in 2 mites, or 2 cents, two small coins. We might say these little copper coins were like penny. She put in 2 Abe Lincolns, these little bitty pennies, or maple leaves if you're from Canada. Put in these tiny little offering. So he said, verse 3, truly I say to you that this poor widow has put in more than all. They were confused. So he explained, for all these, out of their abundance, have put in offerings for God, but she, out of her poverty, put in all the livelihood she had. So what are we to put in? I would suggest we can learn from this that we can put in generosity. Now, generosity is a rather broad word, and that's why I chose it to discuss with us all today. We can ask ourselves, would we be known as generous people? Or is it pretty clear to most people that everything that we get is pretty much for us? It's for me. Are we known as a generous person? Would we be able to, I ask myself, would I be able to give these 2 mites, these 2 copper coins, these 2 pennies, if it was all she had to live on? I would suggest she was a very pious and clearly a very generous woman. She knew she had the faith, apparently, that God would provide, regardless of what she had left over afterward. As we said earlier, are we known for amassing to ourselves, or are we generous toward others? Turn with me to the book of Proverbs. Proverbs. Now again, there are many things we could comment on in this regard, but we'll just ask ourselves, am I putting in generosity? And the reason I bring this up is because it's easy to then have a list. Oh, there's some way I can be generous even today. I can make sure that someone maybe who's visiting, do you have some place to eat tonight? Would you like to come over? Would you like to come with us? We can add you to our party if we're getting together with others. It's easy already to have a list of how we can start to be generous. Proverbs 22 and verse 9. Proverbs 22 and verse 9. It's an unusual phrase, but it's to paint a picture for us. Whoever wrote it, if it was Solomon, we assume it probably was, he wasn't parsing out body parts, but he's making a point. Verse 9. He who has a generous eye, again, he's not parsing body parts to say the rest of the body's totally selfish, but he's got this one googly eye. That's very generous. What is he talking about? Well, talking about a person, obviously, who sees others. You aware that there are those sometimes who don't even see others? no concept of what they're going through, no understanding of the pain or the suffering or the difficulties or the challenges that they may be facing. He who has a generous eye will be blessed. What's he implying is that a generous eye sees that others have needs and works to be able to help them, gives to be able to serve them, a generous person. Why? It goes on to say he gives his bread to the poor, sees a need and strives to fill it. So many times it's challenging, even for God's people, not to focus on themselves and to make every conversation about ourselves. Someone says, my hip popped out of joint. Well, your hip, you ought to see what happened to my ankle a few years ago. Where did we just turn that conversation to? To ourselves. A generous eye recognizes, you know, I've got enough. Got enough. I can give to others and help them. And again, God promises to always care for us. Notice over in chapter 11, Proverbs chapter 11, verse 24. Proverbs 11, verse 24. Solomon says there's this thing that doesn't really make sense in the physical terms. Giving your stuff to somebody else doesn't make sense in the physical sense. It's not a wise thing. I mean, you're giving away stuff that you will use, that you have. Now you've got less. So Solomon is explaining that, you know, it doesn't work that way. When one has a generous eye, God says he'll be blessed. What does he say here? There is one who scatters, in verse 24. There's one who scatters, in other words, gives out. It's not saying throw away. One who gives to others scatters and yet increases more. That is impossible. Except that God is a generous God. He's a very giving God. So we give to others, and God makes sure that we'll always have something more to give. It's an amazing circle of giving. It's God's work. So there's one who scatters, yet increases more. And there is one who withholds more than is right. Pause for a second. A certain amount of withholding is good, is fine. We've got to take care of our family. We've got to do some things with that. But if we withhold more than is right. Now, how do you judge between a right withholding and a wrong withholding? And the answer is, I don't know. But would it be best to err on the side of scattering as opposed to withholding? Probably so. There's one who withholds more than is right, but it leads to poverty. So if the attitude is one, I've got to keep this for myself, I need more, then maybe it's going to disintegrate while it sits there. Verse 25, the generous soul will be made rich, and he who waters will also be watered himself. It's a fascinating statement. You water others, you'll be watered. God will see to it that that will be the case. That's a spiritual truth. And it is a requirement to have faith, to trust that God will actually do this. That he will care for us as we care for others. That we scatter to others and God will make sure we have more. And again, how much do we need? We're not like the world where we're simply in a constant brigade of getting more stuff. It's not the way Christians live. So generosity is one of those things that we might want to put in. There's a second one I've listed here, and that is self-sacrifice. We want to put self-sacrifice into our life. Now, generosity and self-sacrifice are related. But the definition of self-sacrifice is giving up of one's own interests or wishes in order to help others, or to advance a cause, to advance others. Giving up of one's own interests or wishes in order to help others. Self-sacrifice. And again, that's something we can begin to do right away. Sometimes we all fear that Christians might focus too much on sin and not enough on righteous acts. Righteous acts. Sometimes we think, well, as long as I avoid sin, I'm in pretty good shape. Wrong answer. That's putting off. That's putting out. But it's not putting in. It's not putting in. So self-sacrifice. Galatians chapter 1. Synonyms for self-sacrifice are words like altruistic. Altruistic person is one who just gives for the good of the society, for the good of another. Another synonym is benevolent, charitable, chivalrous, self-denying, generous, helpful, humanitarian, incorruptible. You see, if you're incorruptible, you can't be corrupted by the selfish things because they don't have that draw on you. Liberal, loving, magnanimous, noble, open-handed, self-effacing, self-forgetting, selfless. Can we take those words and come up with actions that we can begin doing so that we're putting in that unleavened bread of righteousness, of sincerity and truth? Galatians chapter 1 and verse 1, Paul, an apostle not from men nor through man, but through Jesus Christ and God the Father who raised him from the dead, and all the brethren who are with me to the churches in Galatia. So here's his first statements to the Galatians. Grace to you and peace from God our Father, the Father, and our Lord Jesus Christ. And then he describes Christ. Great place to start Christianity describing Christ, who gave himself for our sins. Absolute self-sacrifice. Gave himself for our sins, that he might deliver us from this present evil age, which we described a bit of in putting off section, putting out section. He might deliver us from this present evil age according to the will of our God and Father, to whom be glory forever and ever. Amen. Paul begins the letter to the Galatians focusing on the self-sacrifice of Jesus Christ, his willingness to give up himself for others. So we can ask ourselves as well, does that characterize our lives? Are we known for sacrificing ourselves for the benefit of others? Going out of our way to help others, to serve others, to go above and beyond, to be a servant who is not just doing what is expected, but a going above and beyond. We're not a selfish servant. We're selfless. Turn over a page, maybe same page, Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20. Galatians 2 and verse 20, where Paul says this, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me. Pause there for a moment. Christ lives in me. So why am I gathering so much concern for self when Christ is to be living in me? And I'm supposed to be living out His life through my approach and my actions and my attitudes. Christ lives in me and in you. And the life which I now live in the flesh is absolutely different from the life the world is living. It's different. The life which I now live in the flesh, I live by the faith of the Son of God, who loved me and gave himself for me. So sacrifice for the benefit of others is something we can all work on and put in. We know there's a lot to put out, but there's also some important things to put in. Generosity, self-sacrifice, and just one more that I'll list here. It is tenderness. Tenderness. Now, some might be saying, there you go, Mr. Modern Man. Guys have to be tender. That's not what I'm talking about. We want men to be men. But we want men to be tender-hearted. Tender-hearted men can have calluses on their hands. That's a good thing. They should also have calluses on their knees. That's a better thing. 1 Peter chapter 3, in verse 8. When I think of a man being tender-hearted, I think it comes a little easier to some ladies. When I think of a man being tender, think of two things. I think of him holding his wife's face in his hands. There's just that tenderness that is there. And I think of a man holding his grandson or his granddaughter. The way he holds that little baby. There's a tenderness there that every man can and should have. 1 Peter 3 and verse 8, finally, so Peter now is summarizing what he's covered up to this point. Finally, all of you, be of one mind. Now he leads down to the issue of tenderness or tender-hearted. But he gives us a to-do list. A to-do list. Here, instead of a sin list, is a list to put in. So similar to what we covered earlier, but now the positive side, put in. What does he say first of all? Be of one mind. In other words, like-minded. Unity of mind. Of one mind. Some translations render this concordant. Be concordant. What does that mean? Concordant means being in agreement. It means harmonious. You're probably familiar with the opposite of that. Discordant. Dissonance. Discordant. Out of harmony. So it says, be in harmony. So if there's someone here that's a part of your congregation, our congregation, that you're not in harmony with, if there's discord instead of concord, we have something to work on. It's not just a matter of, well, I'll avoid that person and therefore we'll be able to get... No, that's hardly being of one mind. It means we got to work on this. Second word tied together with that is compassionate. Be compassionate. Having compassion for one another. One translation is a fellow feeling. In other words, sympathetic. Having compassion. Love as brothers. Love as brothers. Philadelphos. Loving others like a brother. Can we do some things for our family members that we ought to be doing, putting in? And then he uses the word tender-hearted. As far as I recall, this word is only used twice in the New Testament. And it literally, sounds a little funny, but literally the word is having strong bowels. Now this is not an advertisement for stomach aids of some sort. Having strong bowels. Now bowels at that time were considered to be the seat of very strong love and emotion. So when it says have strong bowels, what it's referring to is be completely tender-hearted, right down to the very depths of our bowels. You know, someone says, oh, my stomach, I just yearn to be with this person. It kind of is there somewhere. So you can see why the ancients may have said, well, bowels is where that yearning comes from, that desire, that tender-heartedness. Those who've been separated from loving family for any period of time understand that yearning to be with them. So in biblical terminology, ecclesiastical language, we might say, it means compassion, it means tender-hearted. King James literally uses the word be pitiful, full of pity toward others. Be tender-hearted. So again, we ask ourselves, are those that we need to show tender-heartedness to, regardless of what the response is? The next word is courteous in the New King James. Courteous. The only time this word is used in the Greek, philphronon, means friendly, it means kind. Some translations render it lowly-minded. Be courteous. Simple way to translate courteousness is this: a you first approach toward others. No, you first. No, you go ahead. You first. That's being courteous toward others. And then he goes on to say, not returning evil for evil or reviling for reviling. In other words, we cannot return evil that has been done to us. We don't retaliate. Abuse given to us is not returned in kind. But, he says, a blessing. On the contrary, a blessing. Knowing that you are called to this, that you may inherit a blessing. And again, doesn't make much sense. If this is what God requires of us, that we maintain our own personal arsenal for the defense of our stuff. Someone who wants to take my television, I shoot them for my TV? I mean, is that what we're supposed to do? Not returning evil for evil, but a blessing. The New Living Translation says it this way: do not repay evil for evil. Do not retaliate with insults when people insult you. Instead, pay them back with a blessing. That is what God has called you to do, and He will grant you His blessing. Amplified Translation: never return evil for evil or insult for insult. Avoid scolding, berating of any kind of and any kind of abuse. But on the contrary, give a blessing. Pray for one another's well-being, contentment, and protection. For you have been called for this very purpose, that you might inherit a blessing from God that brings well-being, happiness, and protection. Last thing before we close. We said it was put out, put in, and put on. How do we summarize all that we've covered? Turn with me to Galatians chapter 3. Galatians chapter 3. What do we put on? All this really has been one way of saying put on Christ. Put on Jesus Christ. Galatians chapter 3. In verse 26, and we'll read verses 26 and 27. Galatians 3:26, for you are all sons of God through faith in Jesus Christ. Verse 27, for as many of you as were baptized into Christ have put on Christ. What does it mean to put on Christ? It's not referring to a costume that is put on to mask or to hide the real person, or to project an image that's not true. But to put on Christ in this sense is the sense of putting on clothing that identifies who you are. For example, if I showed you a picture of someone in bib overalls, what occupation would you tend to assume that they work in? Well, in days gone by, that would be a farmer. And why'd they wear bib overalls? Because it kept stuff off their body. Had lots of pockets for tools to hold the things that you needed to work on the farm. If you wore scrubs, it would identify you as someone who works in the medical field. If you wear a white coat, you'd be a doctor or a nurse practitioner. If you were a police officer, you would wear that distinctive uniform to identify yourself. So putting on Christ means we appear outwardly just as we are internally. Our way of life reveals what we are, that Jesus Christ is living in us, and it shows the way we live. When we eat unleavened bread today, we're putting in Jesus Christ. We're to put on that way of life. Finally, let's turn to Colossians chapter 3. So again, we ask ourselves today, have we put on Christ? Does that uniform identify us as to who we represent, as to what we are? Have we put on Jesus Christ? Because we are to put out sin, to put in righteousness, to put on Jesus Christ. Colossians 3 and verse 12, we'll conclude with these two scriptures, 12 through 14. Therefore, again a summary, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, God has set us apart. He loves us. Put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering, bearing with one another. These are the things that one has put on Christ does, is striving to do better every day. Verse 13, bearing with one another, forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, even as Christ forgave you, so you must also do. But above all these things, put on love. God is love. Put on love, which is the bond of perfection. So, brethren, we've been called to an extremely high calling, to a heavy responsibility. We're to put out sin. We're to put in righteousness. We're to put on Christ. So as we keep these 7 days of unleavened bread, maybe we can use this as a refrain. Put out, put in, and put on.